Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal empowerment. You can read my blog at http://howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. Check it out. You'll be glad you did. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free from any place on the world at 1-877-876-5227 or call direct to 530-876-3222. BBS Radio is run by two really wonderful, handsome, darling guys, Don and Doug Newsom. The station was an idea they had to let people be heard, and it's working really well. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show is up and can be found on the BBS Radio site at thespiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. This show and all past shows are available now on the station archives and on the blog. You can find updates on stories from guests we've had on before. Now, at this point in the show, I always explain what the oxymoron of spiritual politician is meant to point out. Why do we try so hard to do the right thing in our personal lives? Why do we think about our relationship with God and then let government use the strategies and tactics of war on us here at home and around the globe? If you examine the science of politics, that's exactly what's happening. Politics is a war that uses deceit, manipulation, and on occasion violence. H.L. Mencken said, "Elections are futures markets in stolen property," and he was right. Think about that. After all, have you ever had a warm, fuzzy feeling about, say, the IRS? Do you know anyone who has? Did you know that there are people who are so frightened of the IRS that they literally can't file their tax returns, even when they don't owe a nickel? It's true. I've known people like that, and the IRS knows it too. I personally had several agents tell me that this sort of thing isn't even uncommon. One of them laughed. Some of those people end up killing themselves, and not the agents. The IRS knows that too. That kind of fear comes with a tremendous amount of power. And do you know what they do about it? Do you know what anybody does about it? They don't do anything. And that's why we all laugh when some comedian says, "Hi, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you." We know the truth, but we laugh because it's hard to acknowledge it, and it frightens us no matter what we say. This week, we have another update on the Ada L. Smith story from New York. You will remember that Ada is the state senator for Queens in New York who has made it a practice for years to vilify and batter and splatter her office workers with coffee. Last week, we heard from Doug Green, who appeared on our show just a few weeks ago. Doug had been assaulted by Smith while he was working as her office manager. He complained about it, refusing to let the matter drop. Last week, Doug called again and told us that an ADA had interviewed us, and we all hoped, against hope, that something was about to happen. But this week, when he called, he told us that the Queens District is having its convention to recommend candidates for the coming election, and evidently they intend to recommend that Smith be returned to office. Of course, that might mean that she's the least violent candidate from Queens, but it could also give credence to the rumor that the people of Queens, New York, have decided that aid bashing should be included as an Olympic event. In politics, you just never know, do you? At least making the abuse of workers and taxpayers an acknowledged event would make it more honest. Now, our guest this evening is in politics herself, but politics of the spiritually correct kind. Loretta Nall, far from wanting to bash her potential constituents, instead wants very much to free them, to unchain and unshackle them from the bonds of bureaucracy. Her campaign is unusual, and so is she. Please welcome Loretta Nall from Alabama, the Libertarian candidate for governor. Loretta?
Good afternoon. How are you doing tonight?
I am doing just fine, and I hope that you're doing just fine, too.
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure, very much so. And I always start by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves. So tell us, who is Loretta Nall?
Loretta Nall is, up until 2002, I was just an Alabama, kind of an Alabama housewife. I've been married for 16 years. I have two wonderful children, ages 13 and 9. And I wasn't anybody. And something traumatic happened that involved the federal government and local police agencies in the state of Alabama. It really woke me up to what's going on in politics. And instead of sitting around and crying, why doesn't somebody do something about this, which is probably all I'd ever done before, like most people, I decided that I was the only one that would be willing to stand up and say the things that needed to be said, and so I jumped into the political arena here in Alabama.
That must have been an amazing moment for you. Would you mind sharing with us what happened?
Sure. Back in 2002, I was home one day, and I was sitting at the computer just kind of generally goofing off on the Internet, and it was in September. And in September in Alabama, in rural areas, we have a lot of helicopter flyovers looking for marijuana grows. And I've never grown marijuana and wasn't growing it then. And so I heard the helicopter coming and didn't really think anything about it. It was like he'll fly over once or twice and he'll be gone. But this particular helicopter stayed for about an hour, round and round, you know, shaking the house and freaking my animals out and blowing dust up in the yard. And I thought, man,
it's
like being in an Iraqi war zone. They've got a cop after me. My God, you know, what on earth? And so So at the end of it, I kind of got ill, and because I'm a libertarian, and I believe I own my property from the ground up, and unless you're flying a medevac over me or a commercial airliner or something, and you really got no business being there. And so I went out with my video camera, and I began to film the helicopter, and I filmed for, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes, came in, sat the camera down, and I had a goose at the time, and for all of you that don't know, a goose is the best watch dog you can have. They're loud, they're obnoxious, they're mean, they'll bite anybody. So he had this really distinctive honk when we would have company come up in the yard, and I had sat the camera down, looked outside as the goose was honking, and I had four big black Dodge Dooley pickups in my driveway, tinted windows. They had ATV trailers on the back, you know, with loaded with four-wheelers. I only owned 2 acres, mind you. And I thought, you know, what on earth? And so I go charging back outside, demanding to know what's going on, and there's about 20 guys that piled out of these vehicles, and none of them had uniforms or law enforcement insignia of any kind. The big guns kind of gave it away, but I figured they were cops. And one flashed a badge at me and said, you know, we're here from the Alexander City Police Department undercover, and our helicopter pilot thinks he saw some marijuana growing on your property. Do you mind if we have a look around? And I said, you know, I think you might need to buy in some glasses before you make another mistake, as costly as this one's going to wind up being. And I said, yeah, I mind if you have a look around. I'm going to go get my camera to film you conducting a warrantless search. And they were already out on the property. They even had, like, little black boxes with ion snippers or something on wires attached to the end, you know, for the things that, you know, they couldn't open the shop door, you know, they'd have a warrant. But they were just kind of sniffing the air to see what they could find.
They were supplied and ready, right?
Oh, they were ready. You know, it was just a matter of deploying the ground troops, and they had to have been sitting nearby waiting for, you know, the call from the helicopter. So I ran back in to get my camera, and it took my 15 seconds to get back out with it, and basically they were all piled up back in their vehicles and hauling behind in a cloud of dust, and they're getting out of there. So the next day I called, I decided, you know, my county at that time had a $400,000 deficit, and, you know, we were losing jobs left and right, and a couple of days before, you know, something happened in Atlanta, Georgia, where somebody thought they heard a terrorist, and the terrorist went down I-75 to Florida, and there's this big helicopter chase. Of course, this is all right after, you know, 9/11, about a year after. And so I called to find out how much it cost to fly that chopper over my house for an hour, how much was fuel, how much did you have to pay the pilot, Or to the yearly
good move. Good move.
I wanted numbers. I was really fixing to, you know, to crunch them. And I got stonewalled. And so then I called the police department to find out who authorized the raid, who all was in it, on and on and on. Got stonewalled again. Basically told it's not my business and that's not public information. I'm like, well, if I pay your salary, then it's, and you're investigating me for something, then you have a right, you know, I have a right to know what's going on.
Well, you think you'd have a right to know as a taxpayer too. You're paying for it.
Honestly, you know, isn't it terrible that they take our money and they use it to oppress us? And that's exactly what happens. They use it to force us to change laws in ways that we wouldn't choose for ourselves. So I decided that I had a friend in Canada named Mark Emery, and I know a lot of Californians and people out on the West Coast know who Mark is. And Mark was my employer for 4 years, and he was my employer after all this began. He hired me to help me get through all of it. So I wrote a letter to the Birmingham News, which is the largest newspaper in Alabama, and it was 176 words, and basically it said, you know, everybody from, you know, the President of the United States, you know, lawyers, judges, doctors, you know, the your next-door neighbor's soccer mom has smoked pot, and they're not bad people. I said we. I included myself in that, we, because I do smoke pot, and I don't back down from it when I'm asked, and I don't want to make it an us and them. If I'm standing up for liberty for somebody else, I'm also standing up for it for myself, and I'm not going to separate myself from them. So I used the word we, and this has never really come up in court. But the Birmingham News published that letter 2 days after the last gubernatorial election in Alabama in 2002, which was November the 7th. And 6 days after that, my husband and I had gone to town to run some errands. We came back home, and we had 5 police cruisers in our yard, and they were all over the property, 25, 30 men, inside the house, inside the shop, you know, ripping my place apart. And so we go in. They make us go directly out back. They called DHR, which is Department of Human Resources, to come and try and take my children that day. And all they claimed to have found in my home was 87 hundredths of 1 gram of pot in an envelope addressed to me. Now, I know people joke on stoners or pot smokers, oh, you got short-term memory loss, but, you know, there's really not anybody alive that I know that smokes pot that puts their name on it in a country where it's not legal, and especially not in a state like Alabama. But they arrested me, took me to jail. The DHR ladies tried to take possession of my children. My kids came home in the middle of the raid, and my neighbor ran out of his house. You know, bring them babies over here. They don't need to see this. And DHR workers went across the street and asked my daughter, who was 5 at the time, you know, who brushes your hair? You have such pretty hair. And she says, my mommy does. And they're like, well, does it hurt? And she says, no. And so my husband said they asked the question, you know, 4 or 5 different times in different ways until finally she conceded and said, well, yeah, well, maybe sometimes it hurts. And then my son, who was 9 at the time, they asked him things like, do you have an email account? And he says, yeah. You play on the computer? Yes. Do you ever get pornographic email in your email account? And he's like, well, yeah, but who doesn't? I mean, at 9. And, you know, just really, really incredibly terrible things. And so that's how I got started in all of this.
So they also assaulted your children.
They really did, and it didn't end there with the kids. When DHR in Alabama opens an investigation on you, they have an open record for 5 years, meaning at any time in that 5 years, if they decide they want to come look at your house or go and see about your kids at school, they can do that. There's nothing you can do. They're like God, basically, when they get involved in your life. And I was terribly uncooperative with them, and it took, you know, my lawyer telling me, basically, you know, they really can take your children, it really, you know, he says you really need to cooperate with them, and that's the easiest way to go. And I almost choked to death on my pride when I had to call them up and say that they could come back to the house, because I told them they weren't going to get back in without a court order. And the DHR thing wound up working out after a while. But what they did, this is all in connection with the public school system as well. So police and public school systems and Department of Human Resources are all really one, you know, one big cabal of evil people. They're all in it together.
You sort of felt gang raped?
Yeah, that's how I felt. Yeah, it's exactly how I felt. So the teacher, as it comes out, what happened in our case was I wrote the letter and it was published, and then the cop, you know, kicked in the door when no one was home, and then after that, it took us 9 months to get a copy of the affidavit for the warrant, and the affidavit included the fact that, first, I wrote the letter, and then second, suddenly my little 5-year-old kindergarten daughter, who wouldn't know a pot plant from, you know, a lemon tree, decides to run up to the school bear cob and divulge this information that we have green leafy illegal pot plants hanging from our ceiling at home, and she saw me throwing them out the back door that morning. And the law enforcement officer used that to get a warrant. That and the letter to the Birmingham News saying that they really ought to stop locking up people for smoking pot was enough for a judge to believe that I was growing marijuana, which I wasn't. And so they got that and came to the house. And then after that, after all of that happened, and I was fighting with DHR and the school, DHR would show up repeatedly. They showed up at my children's school and would question them without their counsel present, without a third-party unbiased adult present. And we weren't made aware that they were doing this until the kids came home and would say, well, DHR came to school today, and they asked me, gee, do you ever see your mom roll up green leafy stuff? Or, gee, what's to eat in your cabinets? What do you have to eat at home? And just, you know, really terrible things, you know, for kids to have to go through.
So what they
were
trying to do was to plant the idea that you were an abusive mother. That you
sure.
Were nuggets.
And that's absolutely what they were trying to do. And of course, I'm not. And the kids, it really ticked my kids off because they love mom, you know, and they love dad. And they know they have a good life. And so, you know, just repeatedly. And then there were instances where, you know, police officers. And when my daughter was in first grade, after she got out of kindergarten with the evil teacher who was actually trying to bribe her with food at one point. But her first grade teacher's husband was a state trooper. And she told me when she came home the first day from first grade, she said, Mom, my new teacher's husband is a cop, too. And I said, well, you know, I said, he doesn't have anything to do with what's going on in our case. And I said, don't, you know, as long as he doesn't bother you or ask you any kind of questions, then don't worry about it. It's fine.
So your kids were made to feel like they were living in sort of almost a concentration camp.
Absolutely. And, you know, made to feel like they were doing something wrong or that they had to feel ashamed of their parents or, you know, that, you know, mom and dad are evil and bad. And it's really hard on them. The times that I've taken them to court with me, you know, and I have a couple of times, my daughter, she just, you know, she just completely loses her composure because she feels like she did something wrong when she did nothing. She never said these things to that police officer. I mean, all of that was fabricated. When they came and busted in my house, there were no pot plants growing or hanging from the ceiling. There was no pot in my house at all, as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, they really have, the kids have been really victimized in this. But that's how I got into politics. That's them kicking in my door without a warrant and deploying, you know, seven government law enforcement agencies on me and then trying to take my kids on top of it, all because they thought I might smoke a joint once in a while. And it was at that time that I said, okay, it's time to stop being a closet pot smoker and really start putting my foot up somebody's ass. This ain't gonna get it.
So what you're saying is that it was really your sense of being a mother and having to protect your children?
Absolutely.
And your sense of, you know, the sense of having your autonomy violated.
Right. You feel
that,
like you've
motivated you to become an activist.
Right. I find that most very successful activists anywhere, the ones that stay with it, are the ones that got kicked in the teeth, you know, one time too many, and they just said, okay, I'm done. And that was kind of me. I'd never, you know, before this, I'd never had any problems with law enforcement, never been to jail, never been arrested, never, you know, I'm just a good taxpaying citizen who's always, you know, I'm on time with my bills, and my kids go to school clean, well-fed, you know, no problems whatsoever, model citizen. And then this, all of a sudden, and there's never really been an explanation as to why the helicopter was there that day to begin with. That has not come up in court yet.
So you haven't done a discovery process and found out why?
We've done a discovery process, but the helicopter raid, which preceded the actual bust of the house by 2 months, we've never gotten anything in discovery on that. We've asked for it, and nobody has come off anything yet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's either they have destroyed it, I would imagine.
Where are you in the court process?
I've been through district court with a bench trial and was convicted of misdemeanor possession and possession of paraphernalia, and now I am awaiting my trial by jury at the circuit level. In Alabama, with most, you know, lower-level misdemeanor cases or whatever, you don't get a jury trial until you have been convicted, and you have to move up one level in court before you're eligible to ask for a jury trial.
Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing here is a level of intimidation aimed at keeping people quiet and getting them to simply say yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am.
That's exactly right, and that's, you know, that's what police are used to. They expect you to instill fear in you, and I know why a lot of people wind up, you know, plea bargaining out, even if they haven't done anything wrong, because, you know, when the police come and they accuse you of drugs, one of the first things they do is they drag your name through the mud in the local newspapers. Then they threaten you with losing custody of your children. They threaten to take your home and your property and your bank accounts and everything that you've ever worked for and that you own, and they can, and you know that they can, to some extent. You know that they'll lie in court, they'll plant evidence, you know, to cover their own behinds. So a lot of people get scared when faced with, I could lose everything that I cherish in my life, or I could fight these people, and I know they're probably going to win anyway and still lose. And so people that don't stand up, depending on the circumstances, you know, I can understand it. I mean, in a lot of cases, it's justified. I've always been a fighter, and I've always, you know, spoke out against things that I felt were kind of wrong or unjust, and I've always been very, very opinionated. And when the cops kicked in my door and tried to haul my kids off, you know,
so
when
you
I've never done anything
action.
To harm.
What action did you take? What did you immediately do? I mean, you had to deal with the stuff at schools. You had to deal with the stuff in court. But you became an activist, right?
Right away. I became an activist the day after the helicopter raid, when they flew over and I had to run them off. And then after the cops came and, you know, tried to take the kids, I figured they thought they would shut me up. You know, that was their intent all along, is we'll just go and we'll find a little something there and then she'll be quiet. But that's just like throwing gas on a fire with me. You can't intimidate me. So what I did was I just fought back hard. I hired an attorney. I began to go on talk radio shows. I really began a huge letter-writing campaign in Alabama, started up the U.S. Marijuana Party and the Alabama Marijuana Party, which spread to, you know, 35 states in less than a year, and just really started, you know, to fight back. And it shocked them. It's caught them completely off guard. I said, you know, in the beginning I should run for governor. And in the beginning I wasn't really serious about it. It was just, you know, something that just came out one day, and it kind of stuck. And that's how I found myself in the position that I'm in today.
And from what you're saying, people in Alabama actually are much more accepting than many other areas that people do smoke pot. They use it medicinally and they use it just recreationally. And so these people, you know, the state was actually going against an accepted practice.
Sure.
And you said, have they always used pot? Have people in Alabama sort of historically used that, or is that a recent thing?
People in Alabama have kind of historically used it back in the early 1900s. I mean, most people, especially the elderly people, grew some. They knew it was good for their arthritis, and we've always used a lot of traditional medicines in this area, herbal-type stuff, things you grow out of the ground, so that's something that, you know, that does have a history in Alabama. And it has a history also, you know, because we like to smoke it. It's kind of boring in Alabama. A lot of places are incredibly rural, and you wind up not having a whole lot to do except maybe drink beer or smoke the occasional joint for some recreation. And, you know, personally, I'd much rather see people smoking pot than, you know, harming themselves and possibly others by, you know, overly indulging on alcohol.
Well, it certainly has fewer calories.
Absolutely.
So you started to get a reputation in Alabama.
Didn't take very long.
And from there, you actually started becoming active all over the United States, isn't that right?
I did. My employer, right after I got started in this, like I said earlier, Mark Emery in Canada, Cannabis Culture Magazine, Emery Direct Seeds, he and I were friends, and he said, I need you to, you know, to help me do the pot TV news. You know, the couple that he had doing it were, you know, trying to fight extradition back to the U.S., so they kind of had their hands full. And he said, I'd like for you to, you know, to start doing a, you know, two or three times a week a video news show to put on the pot TV site. And so that's what I did. I jumped in on that and didn't have any kind of, you know, film experience or whatever. But it was all amateur, kind of undergroundish, and did really well. Got a big following there, and then I did a lot of traveled across the U.S. extensively between 2003 and the end of 2005, speaking at college, you know, campuses, speaking at drug policy reform conferences, at, you know, marijuana rallies, all different kinds of things. And I even took a trip to Colombia, South America with Witness for Peace back in 2004 to study the aerial fumigation project of Plan Colombia.
So this
and
is something that you took to a different level. You found out everything there was to know about the government interference with people doing what they want to do.
Oh, yes.
And you branched out from pot to a lot of other issues, too.
Absolutely. But once you look at the drug war and how it's structured, and then you really get a feel for what the government really is, you see that even though we say the drug war is failing, and it's, you know, it's badly, poorly managed, this, that, and the other, it's really not failing because it's doing exactly what the government intended it to do. One, it's a government jobs program. You know, you get X number of people arrested, we have X number of people that have to watch them in jail. And also, it's just, you know, it's a means of social control, and it's like, you know, teaching people how to think and feel. And the way that it's managed, where it's completely just a cluster, you know what, you look at every other government program and you can see it's the exact same thing. You can apply it everywhere.
Mm-hmm. So you started to see the pattern. You saw the pattern that they where they create a stream of income that goes from us to them in ways that you'd perhaps not suspected before.
Exactly.
And having seen that, of course, that probably motivated you to do even more.
Yeah, but, you know, pot, like you said, the drug war is not the only issue. There are so many other issues today, you know, the illegal war in Iraq, you know, the Bush administration running, you know, roughshod over every right we ever thought we possessed, and at least taking away rights we don't even have yet, as far as I can see. And, you know, it just...
That we haven't had for generations.
Right, and that we'll never get if somebody doesn't do something to get him out of office quickly, like yesterday. But I just decided, you know, it's more than about pot, sure, and that's a big issue to me. We got to look at the public school system. It's a major thing. Teachers, I know we have to have some public education. I'm for privatizing as much as humanly possible. I don't really blame the teachers. They're forced into kind of teaching more social doctrine type stuff as opposed to reading, writing, and arithmetic, which is what they get paid to do. But you got the federal government coming in with No Child Left Behind, which is a one-size-fits-all, you know, program that obviously doesn't fit everyone. And you've got the, you know, federal government waving around $25 and $50 million grants to get schools to teach kids to urinate in cups on demand.
Oh my God.
Be sniffed by dogs, you know, police dogs coming through on warrantless, suspicionless drug searches. And it's that kind of thing. Schools get you ready for a factory life or a prison life. The public school system does. And it's because of the federal government.
A lot of people in Alabama homeschool their kids then?
Not a lot. I think we've got about 25,000 families in Alabama that homeschool. And we actually have really good homeschool laws here. We don't hardly have any homeschool laws here, which is why it's good. And so that's, you know, part of my platform is to make it easier for parents to make the transition from, you know, from public school to private school or to homeschool. And really, you know, in the rural areas in Alabama, like where I live, there aren't any homes or any, private schools that are, you know, religious oriented, and we're not a religious family, and I don't really feel comfortable sending my kids to that, especially in Alabama. You know, like if we were out in California or some other, you know, properly advanced place where it could be taught in a way that, you know, it's not forced, it wouldn't be that way in the South. And so I have to, you know, have to say no to religious schools. And, you know, we haven't homeschooled. The kids do okay, and as far as like academically, both my kids are gifted and they both love school. And the school has actually learned since all of this started back in 2002 that, you know, if something comes up at school, they need to call me first. And call me they do. They email me. They, you know, they are on top of the game now that they understand that I'm not one of the people you're going to push around. And I'm not one of the people that's going to let you urinate and, you know, test my kids or sniff them with dogs. And if that's going on, then you need to call me to come get my kids before it happens. And they have. They've done that.
I'm amazed that they're actually doing that sort of thing in schools there.
Well, we still use corporal punishment in Alabama schools.
Ah.
So.
Interesting. So.
Yeah, you know, go ahead.
This has been a very interesting period for you. And you started out, you didn't have a lot of money. You got a GED. You've never been wealthy. But you decided you were going to do something. And
right.
At one point, you looked around and said, what can I do? Because some things had happened to you. There was the boob issue and there was the panty issue.
Mm-hmm.
And those were two incidents in the recent past that you've actually managed to turn into a fundraising campaign.
Absolutely. That's capitalism at its finest.
Tell us about the boobs debate.
Okay. I'm a fairly well-endowed, good Southern girl, and every now and then I like to wear a low-cut shirt. And so back about 2 years ago when I was doing the Pot TV News, there was a we took a photo out of one of the shows that I did, and I was wearing a low cut shirt, showing a little bit of cleavage. Really nice picture. And it's up, you know, it's on the internet. If you search my name, Loretta Knoll, on Google under images, you'll get, you know, 200 or 300 pictures of me. So I'm at the computer and I get an email alert on my name from Google News. And it's this editor, he's a columnist. He's been writing about politics in Alabama for 55 years. Very highly respected man, talking about my cleavage in his column, about thanking the editor of the newspaper for finding that picture of him to run. He was sure it attracted a lot of readers, but he hoped that his mother didn't see it, and he knew where she went in the afterlife because she wouldn't have approved. And it really, I was like, I read that and I go, I know there aren't two dirty old men in Alabama media sitting around talking about my anatomy. That just cannot be. Especially, you know, with the issues and stuff that are going on here. And the ones that I address are way more controversial than a nice rack, I can tell you that. But, so I decided, I'm going to find out what picture they ran. So I went and bought the paper and saw what picture it was. I sat down and I wrote a letter to the editor of the newspaper that published it, and I told him, you didn't have the right to use that picture. You didn't call my campaign for a campaign photo. You didn't call me for a comment. You know, I think it was a terribly sexist stunt to try and, you know, diminish what I'm trying to do, when there's not an Alabama newspaper that you can crack open on any given day and not see about the prison crisis and what needs to be done. And, I kind of was angry with him at first. And then in the end, I switched it around. I said, well, if nothing else, you secured me the horny guy vote that exists among your readers. And now that you and the rest of Alabama have been introduced to the twins, perhaps you'd like to meet the rest of me. I'll don my burka, and we'll talk about all the rest of the planks of my platform and instead of the one that y'all chose to talk about. And he actually printed the letter in his newspaper and asked me for some yard signs, so the editor was won over. And what's going on now is a friend of mine, a campaign guy working with me here, Steve Gordon, came up with the brilliant idea of taking the whole booby incident and turning it into a flash animation where $2 will allow you to tuck it in my top, and for $20 you can tuck it in my skirt, and for a $50 contribution you will get to see the biggest boobs in Alabama politics. And that's gotten me national media in the last couple of days. It hit yesterday, and tonight I was supposed to do the Alan Combs show. That's been postponed until Monday because of young Mr. Kennedy's entanglement with a traffic barrier in D.C. and Porter Goss resigning from the CIA today.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be Monday night at 10 instead.
Well, that doesn't really seem as interesting as you and the boobs.
I agree, but it's not every day you get bumped by the head of the CIA and a Kennedy, so I guess I can live with that.
And then you had another incident with your panties.
Yeah, I have a brother who's in prison for alcohol-related offenses. Basically, he's an alcoholic, and if you're an alcoholic in Alabama, then you can go to jail. And so my mother and I and my older brother, who's a disabled combat veteran, we went down back in September to visit Randy, and I'm a big prison policy reform activist in Alabama, so the people in prisons know who I am. Commissioner knows who I am. I used to do a radio show about it here in Alabama, and so my mom and I and my brother went down, and I haven't worn panties since my first pregnancy, and I don't really go into detail about why, but I just find them uncomfortable, and we'll leave it at that. You know, if I'm wearing a dress or something, sure, put a pair on, because you don't want them to show people China, but... And my mom, you know, after I told her the things that my OBGYN told me about them, well, she stopped wearing them, too. And so we go, and I booked on the Department of Corrections website for the dress code rules to make sure that wasn't a problem. I called the facility to ask for their rules to see if they said anything specifically about that, and they didn't. So we go down, and the first thing is my brother had on a pair of khaki knee-length shorts, and they said, we're not going to allow you in with shorts on. And so we had to drive 20 miles to, you know, the nearest Walmart to get him, you know, a pair of overalls and come back.
And it had taken 2 hours to get there, hadn't it?
It had already taken us 2 hours to get down there, yes. So then we had to waste another hour going back and forth to get something from Walmart, which is a good 20 miles away. And then we get back and we go in, and I'm out putting things in the car that I know we can't take in. My mother and my brother had already gone into the guard shack. Well, I go in, and my mom is sitting on the couch, and my brother's nowhere in sight. And they said, are you with this woman here? And I said, yes, she's my mother. And they're like, well, she can't go in today. She can't visit. And I said, well, why not? And they said, well, she's not wearing panties. And I said, well, my God, who's going to check on the inside to see if she's got panties on? She's got on pants. And they're like, well, that's just our rules. And I said, you know, I see a lot of rules posted in here, but mandatory panties is not one of them. So it wound up, they wouldn't let her stay inside the air-conditioned guard shack. And this is in September in Alabama, and it's really monstrously hot. And they
how
they,
old's your mom?
My mom is 61.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, she says, well, I'll just go sit in the car. And they're like, no, if you're not visiting, you have to leave state property, which we own state property, so I don't really follow that rule. And my mom doesn't want to drive in strange places. And then when she got to the parking lot, she couldn't even find the car. So I can imagine how bad it would have been if they'd actually gotten her off the property. But anyway, I was standing in the guard shack waiting to be searched. And both of the women came back in and said, you can go ahead and go through and see your brother. And I hadn't been searched, and I looked at them and I said, are you sure? And they said, yeah, you know, go ahead and go on through. I said, but neither of you have searched me yet. And I thought about not saying anything, but I figured if they realized once I was in that they hadn't searched me, then we'd get the fist of glove treatment on the way out. And I wasn't in for any of that particular day. So I said, you didn't search me. And one of them took me in the room to search me. And she was the pro panty guard that had denied my mother. And it's like, lift your bra. You know, shake it out, take off your shoes, show me the bottom of your feet, turn down the waistband of your pants, and let me see your panties. Uh-oh. I had forgotten that I don't wear panties either, haven't in years, and wound up not being allowed to see my brother and had to, you know, drive back home, you know, the 2 hours. Big disappointment. He was upset. You know, we were all, I was really irate. And if anybody wants to read that, it's a hilarious recounting of what happened. It's the Great Prison Panty Rebellion of Alabama.
And where can people find that?
They can find that at the Nall for Governor website under the articles link on the left.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of stories there that I've written about my adventures in drug policy and prison reform in the great state of Alabama that are amusing. At the same time, they make you just want, you know, claw your eyes out.
They
make you so angry.
They didn't even understand that you were people or that they were working for you?
No. In the prison systems and in the court systems, it's like if you have somebody in jail and you go to see them, then automatically you're equally as bad as they are because you're related to them. Like, you couldn't be much better because you got the same bloodlines. In the court system, and I've experienced this a number of times, they treat you as soon as you walk in, before you've had your trial, like you were guilty. And you are a number in the Department of Corrections, and they can mistreat you any way they like. They can talk to you any way they like, do anything they like to you while you're in the courtroom, dehumanize you. You know, I saw them once make a 70-year-old lady wouldn't let her out of the courtroom to go to the bathroom, told her that she would not be able to get back in if she left. And Grandmama, she, you know, went and sat down for a minute, and she got up and walked out. You know, I was like, go, Grandma. You know, I wouldn't take it either. And, just, you know, they're vicious and they're brutal, and they are of the mentality that they own you whether you have been convicted of a crime or not.
Well, they wouldn't own you even if you had been convicted of a crime.
Exactly.
But that shows an incredibly calloused, attitude toward the citizens of Alabama. What do the citizens of Alabama think of the way that they're treated?
They don't care for it very much. I've gotten so much reaction out of my campaign, so many disgruntled people who have had, you know, run-ins with the law and been, you know, hearing about if you've got money and you get a run-in with the law, they'll take all your money and let you get out of it. But if you don't have money, you know, of course you go to jail.
So in many, many different ways, this is simply another way of milking you for money.
Yeah, it's you know, it's government-sanctioned theft. It's government-sanctioned gangs is what, you know, the cops and the judicial system have become here. They're gangs. The only difference between them and a street gang in an inner city is this gang has the authority of the government to be a gang. I see no difference whatsoever anymore.
And you said you're getting a lot of support for your campaign.
I get a lot of feedback from across Alabama, you know, contributions. We're not nearly where we need to be as contribution-wise, but I get Republicans writing me saying I've been a lifelong Republican, but I'm voting for you. Democrats say the same thing. Independents, people who say I haven't voted in 10 years or I never even bothered to register. I was so disgusted by the time I was 18, I just didn't care. I'm going to register this year, signed up a lot of people to vote. They're ready. They know that the government is not their friend in Alabama. They know that all of the politicians, aside from myself, they're all cut from the same cloth. They all want to try and out-Jesus each other and try to play who loves Jesus more in this election. And I get actually, even though I'm
like Jesus.
I'm an atheist, and I am more Christ-like in my actions toward my fellow Alabamians than anybody in elected office.
Which brings us to an interesting point. Are you going to be on the ballot? Because I know ballot access in Alabama for statewide offices is the worst in the United States.
That's absolutely right. At this point, we're in a desperate struggle. the Libertarian Party in Alabama is small. Of course, they pass laws to, you know, basically to eliminate us from the playing field. You have to get 41,300 registered voter signatures here. If you get that and manage to not get them, any of them disqualified, you get on the ballot. But if you don't get 20% of the vote in the election, you lose your ballot access status, and you have to do it all over again the next time you want to run. Right now, we've got roughly 10,000-12,000 signatures, and we have until June 6th to come up with our 41,300. We're very seriously lacking in funds. That's what we're hoping to do with the Flash for Cash campaign, was raise enough money to get ballot access petitioners here on the ground next week. And it's slow going. I don't know if you've got contributors listening to your show, but if there are people who care about being able to vote,
they should definitely send you money.
Please send us money.
How can they do that? To go to your website and go through the Flash for Cash?
They can go through the Flash for Cash if they want to do that, or there's a contribution link on the left-hand side of the Knoll for Governor site as well, where you can, you know, donate any amount you like. And there's no limit on how much a private citizen in the U.S. can contribute to a campaign. Corporations and businesses are limited to $250.
Mm-hmm. I hope that everybody donates. I know that ballot access in Alabama is incredibly difficult, and that means it's a very high-ticket item. Every time there's election, you want to have people on the ballot. You have to go through the same process, and it's generally about $1 a signature to do it. So you're talking about at least $100,000 every time.
Right. In order to be able to get enough, you know, signatures that will qualify, you have to go way over, you know, the number that they say you actually need, because a bunch of them won't be valid, or they'll, you know, disqualify them for some little piddly reason that they can, you know, pull out of thin air. So
and
it's
haven't
very
they changed? Haven't they changed ballot laws every time it looked like you might be getting some traction? Because I know that Alabama in the 70s had no requirement at all. You could just call up and ask to be put on the ballot.
Exactly, and they changed it in the late 70s in the legislature to what it is now. I think 78 or 79, and of course I was only 2-3 years old at that time, so I don't remember what all was going on that made them change it. And it's really a terrible thing, you know. Basically, in Alabama, you're only allowed to vote for state-sanctioned candidates. And people of Alabama, you know, we're portrayed as, you know, Bible-thumping, toothless, tobacco-chewing, snake-dancing, holy-rolling rednecks. There are a lot of wonderfully progressive people here who have, for reasons of propaganda and for just the way that things are in Alabama society-wise, live in fear of speaking out, and with good reason. I mean, I spoke out and went to jail. And they really, you know, there's a lot of people coming together around me, the disgruntled and the disenfranchised, and I speak, you know, for the immigrants, I speak for, you know, the gay rights in Alabama. I'm the only person who does these kinds of things. There really isn't an issue that's too controversial for me really to take on here. I'm not afraid of it. The Democrats and Republicans are mortified of me being on the ballot now. I've already been invited to one debate, which is coming up this month, and they haven't given me the date for it yet, where all the other candidates will be there for Democrats and Republicans. I'm sure they are. You know, they've seen me. I've spoken to, you know, the VFW in Wetumpka, which is near Montgomery, and I went in as an anti-drug war, kind of speech, and it was a den of lies. I came out with those guys buying me free shots of whiskey. They love me. You know, the vets love people who speak truth to power. They know they're getting screwed, too. I've been and spoke to the Alabama Conference of Black Mayors, and they understand what's going on. Got a lot of support there. I've been invited to the PTA candidate forums, which I did about 2 weeks ago in Huntsville. We spoke to, you know, the state's, you know, highest-ranking educators, and did a better job than anyone else. And I've gotten a couple of teachers now down around Montgomery who say, hey, let's get together and do a fundraiser. Public school teachers, mind you, that know that I am anti-public education to a great extent, but they like what I have to say. So, you know, I'm pulling from all sides. I appeal to the Republicans because I'm fiscally conservative, whereas Bob Riley, we know he's not. You know, the first thing he did after he took office was try to increase our taxes $1.2 billion in the name of Jesus. And then, you know, Roy Moore, who has, you know, publicly stated that he would execute homosexuals if he could get a law passed to do so.
Homosexuals?
Absolutely. It was written in one of his briefs from the Alabama Supreme Court. It's available on the Internet. And, of course, he's the Ten Commandments judge, for folks listening that don't know. So Roy wants to, you know, get in office and kill everybody who refuses to bow to his will. And then you've got indicted former Governor Don Siegelman, federal racketeering charges, bribery scandal. He's in court now. And then you got Lucy Baxley, who's a Democrat. All she's got to stand on is a little sign that says, "We heart Lucy." She came out in the media the other day and said she hasn't talked a lot about the platform she's running on because, well, she doesn't want to make any promises that she can't keep. So she's not going to give any opinions on where she stands on anything. And literally, she says, "I'm not talking."
Mm-hmm.
And it blew me away. You know, how are people supposed to know, you know, anything about you if you don't tell them where you're going with it, what your vision is? Well, I'm not going to give you my vision because I might not be able. Well, you know, I was dumbfounded. So Moore's not going to get the Republican nomination. Riley will. Baxley will get it on the Democratic side because Siegelman's trial is not going to be over in time for the primary. If I get on that ballot, I will be the only one who can pull the fiscal conservative vote from Bob Riley. They're not going to vote for Lucy Baxley. She's running, even with her opponent in the Democratic primary being in such horrible legal trouble, she is still behind him in polling. And there's an additional 33% of the Democratic Party in Alabama that's undecided. I have a huge potential here. I could get elected in Alabama. The people of Alabama are ready for somebody who is not a billionaire, businessman, you know, entrenched federal Washington, D.C. guy. Those people don't relate to us. They don't know us and can't possibly imagine what it's like to live life as us for one day. And I know if I get on the ballot, it is going to be one big horse race.
That would be fantastic. What do you want for the people of Alabama?
I want the people of Alabama to be protected by their government and their pursuit of life, liberty, happiness, and property. I want the people of Alabama. I want the politics of hate in Alabama to not exist here anymore. I think that kind of mentality has kept us back more than anything else. You know, it's instead of, you know, black people now being the target of that, the white supremacist and the League of Southern men and the KKK are all jumping over to the, you know, to the immigration thing. And we really don't have an immigration problem in Alabama. I know a lot of the Hispanic people here working. I see them. They're clean. They're taking care of their kids. I've never seen a Mexican in Alabama with a food stamp card. These people work, and they do pay taxes. They pay sales taxes. If they're working at Tyson or at Russell Mills or whatever, taxes are coming out, and those are taxes that they'll never be able to use. They'll never get Social Security. They'll never be able to use the health care system, you know, if they had to. So, you know, what we're seeing here in Alabama is the white supremacists, you know, turning their attention away from African Americans and turning it over to Hispanics.
But what you're really saying, though, from everything that you've said, is that they're really looking for a way to create another plantation system. But in this time, instead of just focusing on the blacks, they want the whites, too.
Sure. And the Hispanics. See, in Alabama, and I hope nobody's offended when I say this, because I say it here to black audiences and they understand, there's this thing in Alabama where it's like the government always has to have a new class of niggers to step on. You know, the black people here finally got tired of it. We've got the wonderful civil rights movement and all the great things that came out of that. And then, you know, it moved to people who smoke pot, okay, so they can be the new class, or homosexuals and lesbians, they could be the new class, or the Mexicans. It's any minority that they deem small and powerless that they can use as, you know, as a scapegoat. These people are evil, they're destroying our country, let's, you know, form a mob and lynch them kind of mentality. And people of Alabama don't really feel that way. It's just the ones in power have all the power. You know,
so
they have most of the power.
Would you say they've become sort of addicted to government? That
they
have. A class of people in Alabama addicted to government who are using it to create a plantation system.
That's exactly what they're doing. They know that people in Alabama vote their emotions. If you can rile them up about an emotion, you can have a fun election. You can get elected again. If you say, you know, I hate homosexuals and wish they would die, boy, you'd probably get the issue in here. In a lot of ways, or you know, whether or not we're going to have the Ten Commandments in public classrooms, and these kinds of issues are, you know, you get a knee-jerk reaction. You rile up somebody's emotions, and then it distracts them from what's really going on in the state government, which is we're being robbed. You know, we're being robbed of our rights and our money and our property and everything that we're supposed to be guaranteed of as American citizens. They use things like gay marriage and the Ten Commandments and And, you know, the immigration here in Alabama to distract people. I'm so sick of these issues. You know, banning gay marriage is not going to make homosexuals not be homosexuals anymore. It's not going to put food on my table. It's not going to bring better jobs here. It's not going to get my kids a good education. You know, it's not going to keep my family safe. And so it's not an issue. But they make it an issue. And they people, this is in all over the U.S. Some politicians get elected and they decide that their only job is to be reelected. They don't care about what they do while they're in office. Their only job is concentrating on the polls 4 years from now.
Do you think a lot, if you were elected governor, do you think it would be a very different place to live?
It would take a long time. The way that things work in Alabama, the legislature has the majority of the power, the House and the Senate. The governor is just kind of a figurehead. Now, you have power where you can introduce stuff, you can push stuff, and you have leverage. What's going to take in Alabama, if I get elected, yeah, it's going to be a different place. The legislature, mostly, a lot of them are running unopposed this year, probably give me some problems, you know. It may be slow coming about, but, you know, one of the first things I'm going to do if I'm elected is, you know, sign an executive order stating that that you can't legalize marijuana, that it will be absolutely the lowest law enforcement priority for every law enforcement officer in this state. If you don't have something else to do, then that you better not be, you know, out rounding up, you know, people just for smoking weed. And hopefully, as y'all tell the Attorney General, basically the state's not going to prosecute these cases. If you want to prosecute them at the county level, well, that's up to the county. The state is not going to be prosecuting drug offenses. We're not going to be prosecuting prostitution. For people that steal $50 VCRs or write bad checks or don't pay their child support, we're not going to lock them in prison. We're going to find something that's more creative and a little more constructive and a lot less expensive to make them do the things that they're supposed to do.
Oh, that sounds like Alabama would be a very different place.
It would be
moving in a very different direction. And if you had one core message that you would want to leave people with tonight, what would that be about your campaign?
I would like to leave people with the message that the rich, powerful, and elite have stolen our election and political process from us. They believe that if you don't have $1 million or $2 or $1 billion, that you have no business leading. That if you don't have a high-priced, fancy college education, you have no business in public office. And my response to that is there are way more people in the United States of America and in the state of Alabama who are poor or just barely have enough to get by, who are regular common people, than there are these rich bastards running our country. And it's time for us, the poor, the disenfranchised, it's time for all of us who are tired of living with the boot of government on our neck to do what Thomas Jefferson said, to rise up and throw off the chains of usurpation and start all over again. And it's going to start with common people because rich people only represent rich people. And not that there's anything wrong with being rich. Don't get me wrong. I am libertarian. But this is our country and our government, and the people running it need to be kicked out. A lot of them actually need to be locked up. But we, as a people, as American citizens, true patriotic Americans, have to stand up, and we have to do it now.
Amen. Well, Retta, thank you so much for being with us this evening, for taking the time. And we enjoyed hearing about your campaign, and we're going to look forward to updates. Thank you, and good luck, and all the listeners out there, send checks.
Thank you so much, Melinda. Had a wonderful time.
Great. You take care.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that's our show for today, Friday, May 5th, 2006. The point of being free is owning yourself and your life, just like Loretta said. Doing the right thing, instead of just talking about it, is something that you have to get up off your hind, get off of your butt and really do. The people of Alabama are fortunate to have the opportunity to vote for Loretta, I think, and I think you're going to agree with me. I want to thank all of you for being with us tonight, for listening and thinking about where we are and where we really want to be in our country and in our states. Life is process, and by coming here and listening, we have the opportunity to think about the values we live by and what we want government to be as a tool. And on this show, as on every show, as we do with all of our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. A mission statement encapsulates what we want to do and where we want to go. And Thomas Jefferson had a mission statement that all of us believe in with all of our hearts. And he wrote the following. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Sometimes in life things just happen. We don't need to think about it because we know what we have to do. And when that happens, it's because we have followed the clarity of our values, and our values tell us where we really are and where we need to go. As Americans, freedom remains our destination and our goal. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.